My name is Claire Press, and this is Wardrobe Crisis, the podcast that unzips fashion's issues.
Do you mind if I move the microphone? I need to lounge.
Devotion, darling. J'adore. I found the velvet and the fit of you.
It's all I'm all that they are, because I love you. I think as humans, we are major forces to be also reckoned with. And I think creativity always flourishes when there is any type of crisis.
That's been the absolute pleasure, is watching talented people who have skills far and beyond mine come together and work collectively.
Einstein always said, nature has all the answers. Just look to nature, it has all the answers.
Just because I happen to be able to source them easiest, I guess. I was buying original wool jackets in the 1950s. I was buying them at Portobello Market. And a one man's rubbish is another man's gold.
For me, it was about age, it was about the attitude of people, and it's about how they're wearing the clothes, why they're wearing the clothes, and capturing a bit of their wisdom and empowering people to look at aging differently.
Join me every week as we talk ethics, sustainability, and the business and madness of fashion. From who made your clothes to how they impact on the environment to the politics of personal style, we are so hot right now. My parents feel that this is a waste of time. I tell them, yeah, because everything is just fine. Hello, dear listeners. I'm so happy to be back with Series 2 of the Wardrobe Crisis podcast. I've missed you, and I have a very good feeling about 2018 already. I'm sure you guys are doing some amazing things with your slow fashion journeys, and I'm really looking forward to hearing about them. You can tag me on Instagram and Twitter, at Mrs. Press. I have news too, which I've been itching to share. As some of you may know, I spent the early years of my career in fashion magazines at Vogue, and now I'm back. I've just been made Vogue Australia's sustainability editor at large, which is a bit of a first. How cool is it that the editor-in-chief, Edwina McCann, is throwing her weight behind sustainable and ethical fashion? It's pretty cool. I am excited. So I can't wait to share with you all the stuff that we're going to be doing over the coming months. American listeners, if you've been hanging out to get a copy of the Wardrobe Crisis book, your time has finally come. It's out in the US on February the 20th. Now down to business. A lovely business it is too. Our first guest for Series 2 is Gosia Piatek, the fabulous force behind the label Koto. Gosia is a delight, and this is a beautiful conversation in which we start off talking about minimalism, and how she's going as a dedicated minimalist living with a man who is the opposite. We talk about her life and the pressures of running a business between London, where she now lives, and New Zealand, where Koto is based. She shares about her early life as a refugee from Poland and what it was like for her family to arrive in New Zealand knowing no one, and how Gosia grew up as a greenie. The story of how she began her label is fascinating and very unusual, and I'll let her explain exactly how she began. You'll hear how she built the label according to her values, her interest in art, architecture, craftsmanship, landscape, and travel. And we delve into how she manufactures. Her thing is transparency. And Gosia is one of the only people I know who can make supply chains sound sexy. But seriously, there's something very fresh and inviting about how Gosia humanizes this conversation around who makes our clothing and textiles. Koto's fabrics are all exclusive and designed in-house. So what that means is they might spend a whole year developing a particular weave of cotton or organic denim or lately wool, which is a new addition. It's really slow fashion and it's really considered, and it's absolutely not designed to be obsolete season in, season out. The label is a pioneering one when it comes to using fair trade certified cotton and GOTS approved dyes and mindful manufacturing in general. Everything is sourced sustainably, even down to the trims and the packaging. And I know that when I first started working in this space, it was always Koto, Koto, you have to know about Koto, which sounds like the lyrics for a bad poem or song, and that's not what I meant it to sound like. But, God, I'm going to make a little song out of that. Anyway, you got me, Koto. What was I going to say? I was going to say something so smart and just got derailed. Oh, well, never mind. Enjoy this interview. I hope you enjoy it as much as I enjoyed recording it. Gosia is a treasure. Welcome, Gosia.
Thank you.
I'm delighted to be doing this with you.
Oh, great.
Welcome back to Sydney via London and New Zealand.
Yeah, so nice. I love it here.
So let's talk a little bit about London. When did you move there?
Well, it was now maybe 4 years ago. I still don't permanently live there because I met my partner in India whilst I was sampling the range in a hotel for one day, and we fell madly in love and decided...
In one day?
Yeah, and decided to have a baby over Skype. And thought that was a good idea. And then 4 months later, we met up in London via Indonesia, and I fell pregnant just after Christmas. And then...
And this was like, I mean, your son is now 3, is that right?
Yeah, yeah. So he's got a very full career in London. He's a film director, and I have a very full career in New Zealand. So we travel back and forth. So we only arrived in New Zealand as a whole family 2 days ago. Yeah.
Crazy town.
Yeah, so my son's school changes every 6 months, and... Or more like every 4 months. I travel back and forth every 3 or 4 months.
It's hectic.
Mm.
The global fashion industry is kind of peopled by peripatetic creatives. People do move around a lot, but I don't think that they have to juggle being based in different countries and running a business quite as hectically as you do.
Centered over the edge, I think. Yeah, that's been crazy with the little baby.
We'll get back onto that, but let's just talk about the business. Mm-hmm. So for those listeners who might not be aware of the wonder that is Koto, can you tell us a bit about the label?
Well, I started the brand 11 years ago with a very... I never studied fashion, so for me it was a very clear... I wanted to start a business that created change from the moment it was conceived to whatever it was. And I was thinking, do I go into food or do I go into... I was just tossing up so many ideas. And my partner at the time was a graphic designer, and I met up with a friend and she said, well, why don't you start a fair trade organic cotton clothing brand? It was very specific. And I was like, what does that even mean? And 11 years ago, I Googled it.
And, get out.
Yeah.
I love this story.
And I thought, okay, I can do this. And I thought, wow, this is really fascinating, this idea that you know and you can trace something from seed to garment. I just was really fascinated by it. And we started off with a kind of a luxe basics brand, really. And now it's evolved into denim and knitwear. And the exciting development for next season is that we're introducing new fibres. So that's really how it started.
But how extraordinary, and I haven't heard of anyone else talk about a fashion brand that they've started in quite this way, because you began purely with values.
Definitely.
Before you began with this idea of, I want to be in fashion.
Yeah, it was all values driven, definitely. And I was always interested in design. That was definitely something that came naturally to me. So whether it went into building or interiors or even food or cafe or, you know, restaurants, I think.
Fascinating.
I found it can cross over.
Okay, so let's talk about the name.
Mm-hmm.
What is Koto?
Koto or Kowtow. I say Koto, but most people would pronounce it Kowtow. In front of the emperor in China, they would go on their hands and knees and bow with their forehead touching the ground as a sign of respect. And when I saw the word, I thought, oh, this is, it's great. Like, it's got an kind of a, even though it's Chinese, it's got this kind of Asian flavor, and I've always loved this kind of Japanese minimalism idea. And kotoclothing.com was available. Very important.
It's so practical.
So practical.
But also, there's
everything
a kind
has
of,
pockets.
So. Love. But there is a poetic element to it too, because you're talking about respecting supply chains, respecting fibres, respecting people.
Yes, of course, yeah. So it was just, and it was a word that not everybody knew in our language. It was a word that's almost been expired. You know, you'd read it maybe in a novel or... And, you know, to this day, 11 years on, I can't imagine it being any other name. That's quite nice because I didn't name it after myself. So it's nice. And we haven't even changed the logo, actually, the font. I just really like it.
It was meant to be.
And we change everything, you know, how it is in fashion. Like, you change everything every 6 months. So it's amazing that this has got longevity.
You mentioned your love for Japanese minimalism.
Mm.
When I think of Koto, I think minimalist, beautiful, restrained, a muted palette, which I love from a distance because I'm, as you know, hectic, covered in silver glitter woman. I actually have a beautiful shirt dress that's Koto, but I would wear it with lots of extra bedazzles.
Yeah, yeah.
This is a question that often foxes me in the sustainability space because minimalism is the kind of code that everyone loves within this space. There's not a lot of sustainability advocates who are aesthetic maximalists.
Oh, it's so interesting, isn't it? I mean, I'm a minimalist. I don't have much in my wardrobe. I have a very small home. I don't have much on my walls. I don't miss it. And when I met my partner in London, he's a maximalist. Like, it's insane. I mean, I said to my friend one morning, I said, I'm really bored. And she said, don't worry, there's probably a whole bunch of Guardian supplements sitting on the floorboards that you can just read all day and get old recipes out of. And I looked around and there was just like, they were like snaking around the skirting boards.
This is my life.
Yeah.
So your partner Thomas is a film director and obviously a collector of...
God, just an insane...
all things.
All things, like everything, you know, shells and jars. I mean, it gets bizarre. You know, little boxes with safety pins and a dime in them. Yeah, so...
Open drawers, find collection of coins from somewhere you're never going back to.
Oh, of course, yeah. There's bags of them. So I've actually decluttered his whole house and colour-coded his books, which he thinks is ridiculous because he can't find anything, which is true.
What about those people who turn the book spine inside so that you only see the minimalist outer
Oh,
pages?
I haven't even seen that.
I've seen it in, like, World of Interiors.
Oh, wow.
So that's, you never want to know what's in there because it's all about the aesthetics.
That's brilliant.
Just no.
That's brilliant.
But what's the beauty of minimalism to you?
Well, for me, it's headspace. So for me, I feel... happy, it affects my mood. So when I'm in a place where there isn't too much to look at, which is the opposite of how you or Thomas might feel, is I feel completely at calm and ease, and I feel like stress is lifting off my shoulders. And that's probably why I'm not designed for really crazy urban city environments, but I love Sydney because you can have both, you know. And I love seeing the horizon, I love seeing the ocean, and I'm very driven by colour, which is interesting, that goes through into our work. So we work with colour really closely, so we develop all our own colours and our own yarns, and, you know, we go into quite a lot of depth in that. So, and our clothes tend to come in colour blocking. I think we are, at the moment, we are going through a rethink about how we do design, and at the moment the very minimal range will become our Koto building blocks. So it will be our simple everyday weekend uniform clothing, and then we want to create a higher end range where we are looking into embroidery and we are looking into different buttons. And I think that
I spied a ruffle. Yes, on a sleeve. I did.
You did spy a ruffle.
I was like, I've seen you.
Yeah,
you exist.
Yeah. And I think that also comes from having a bigger team. So having now I employ over, you know, I think there's 25 of us now, and the design team's just doubled, so we've got more capacity to create more time into each garment.
But I don't want to imply that we're talking about in any way starkness or anything jarringly overly monastic or simple, because that isn't what Koto is. It's actually about the beauty of restraint, but without this, it's soft. It's not like you look at it and go, I can't live in that world if you're not a purist.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're very arts-driven in the way we approach design, so, and we're always driven by the same. You know, we look at Tada Ando for architecture, or I've just been to Palm Springs, so we look at mid-century homes and the restraint that's there, but there's still
the shape.
The shape, and there's still the kind of, there's design in it, you know, and that's how we look at a sleeve. So everything has this kind of deliberate aspect to it. We don't just go, oh, put a pocket on it. We talk about that pocket for days. You know, let's make it, are we going to have it bigger or smaller? And I think it should go down a centimetre. Let's create the hem a little bit more oversized to create drama to match the shape of the shirt. You know, it's, we talk about it like a piece of art. We don't just say we need to create a white shirt. It's quite a lengthy conversation that's been going on for 11 years.
Talk about a pocket for days is adorable.
Yeah, and that's what I feel excited by. I think I love design. Yeah.
But also the utilitarian or the practical is important, isn't it? Do you want to
I think I get that from my mother. She always says to me, oh, I like that dress, but it doesn't have any pockets. And I just feel like I'm failing her if I don't put pockets in it. Yeah, I'm
Polish practicality.
Totally. I'm like so practical. I mean, I think it kills my partner because he's such a dreamer. You know, we're very different.
You can't have two people the same in a relationship that works, I don't think.
Yeah.
You can have people who look just like their dogs, and that seems to work. I always see that on the street.
Yeah.
Don't you always see
always.
People who are like the bulldog man, the bulldog dog?
Yeah, yeah.
But I reckon in a partnership, it's easier to deal with when people are very different because they balance each other out.
Yeah, we're very different. I mean,
do you like how I brought that back to dogs in the street?
But it's true.
You mentioned your mama would say to you, but where are the pockets? Where's the practicality?
Mm.
Do you want to rewind a little bit and mm-hmm. tell us a bit about how you began,
mm-hmm.
how YouGosia began? Mm-hmm. So you were born in Poland.
Yeah, so we were...
You moved when you were seven?
Yeah, as refugees in 1985 to Italy. We escaped Poland, so you weren't allowed to leave back
communism
then.
It was before 89.
That's right, yeah. So it was a closed border country. And Chernobyl exploded, and that was in Russia. But mum had enough. There wasn't food on the shelves. In the supermarket, you got a little ticket. There was queues to line up to the people that gave you the food. It was very limited. And mum's quite adventurous, and she pretended that she was in a car racing club. And so the government would issue her with a passport, and we had a temporary departure card out of Poland. And so we drove and pretended we were going on holiday to this car rally. I don't know where this even came from. Dad had a passport because he was a sailor, and us kids had them. So when we got to Italy, we went into a refugee camp for 2 years, which it was amazing. We had our own house on the beach. We ate pizza and pasta, and the Italian community just welcomed us with open arms.
Very. That makes me cry to hear a positive refugee story when you think of the context of now, a million people on the move and being turned away at every gate.
I think it just, there wasn't that flood. I mean, it really was such a different time, whereas now people just don't know what to do. They feel overwhelmed by the masses. Yeah, mm. I feel overwhelmed in Europe. Mm. And
so then from Italy, what happened? Did you stay there a while?
2 years, waiting for either Canada, New Zealand or Australia were accepting refugees. And finally New Zealand accepted us, and we flew to Wellington. So
how old were you when you got there?
I was seven, and then it wasn't such a positive story actually for my parents. It was quite stressful. New Zealand, I think, in 1987 didn't have the infrastructure to know what to do with us. But mum,
how was your language?
We didn't have English. My brother had English because he had private tuition. So he was the one that would... He's 8 years older, so he was a teenager. But so hard on him. Such a impressionable time to be leaving everything behind, and pimply-faced teenager coming into a new culture. It's so full-on. But, you know, Dad, he was a sailor, so he worked for Sea Lord. He scrubbed the deck for a couple of years. They realised he was actually very bright. The New Zealand fishing industry made him reset all his exams. His nautical schooling in Poland wasn't recognised, the
you
usual
hear this
story.
Over and over.
Even though he'd sailed boats all around the world. But anyway, they realised that he was a clever man, and within a few years he became captain of one of the big industrial fishing vessels. So we had a very quick rise into comfort.
He has deep-rooted, sustainably-minded values, doesn't he?
I think so, yeah. You wouldn't know because he's a sailor.
Didn't he do something with nets?
A practical guy. So I really love having philosophical conversations with him. I think he is a conscientious person. So he was working for the company that he was working for, and he invented a fishing net that would let the little fish out and only let the big fish in. And he presented that to the board, and within a few weeks he got made redundant.
So they didn't take it up?
No, of course not.
I thought they did.
No, of course not. So he got made redundant.
So they didn't like that he was being disruptive?
No, it's a big industry with a lot of money to be made. So it's why create change when you can just pillage? So
where do you think that that's an extraordinary story.
Yeah.
Where in that tale do your values come from? Because coming forwards again and thinking that you wanted to start a business, but you didn't really know exactly what, but you knew how and why.
I think, mum and dad, with their Polish practicality, I was always taught that you turn the lights off and they're like, we're getting an induction cooker because it goes from zero to whatever degrees in 2 seconds, and that's going to save us energy. And we've put solar panels on our roof to heat our pool. And then it's like they do it without even thinking about it. Mum makes bread and she makes her own ricotta because it tastes better. She goes to the farmer's market to get olives because they taste better. And you would never hear them talk about sustainability or ethics. But the way they live is actually completely in line with my own values. And on the weekends, we would always go walking in the hills as a family.
Wellington's beautiful.
Beautiful.
Physically extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah.
Dramatic.
And I think that came from that too. And then I started snowboarding quite a lot. So I went and would go to North America or Canada, and I started you know, I think that really had an effect on me, maybe in the minimalism world as well, just that sense of white space.
I was going to say, because that's what it is, extraordinary.
And I'd always want to get away from the runs from all the people, and I'd always go backcountry, and just hearing me doing turns in the snow and seeing it, it was like spiritual experiences. I've never felt so happy probably since than doing that. That was to me the, you know, I felt like I was like, yeah, I'm doing well in life. This is...
That's glorious, actually, isn't it? That's also poetic, that idea of the swish, swish and the feeling and just the sparkling.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Nothing interrupting it.
Nothing, and everything, all your worries just dissipating, you know? It just, that's, I guess, people get that through eating well or exercise or maybe their career, their job, if they own the perfect career for them. But, you know, that feeling is pretty amazing, yeah.
A sort of sharp point, or the art of getting to that point. You can get it through meditation, I hear.
Yeah.
I didn't. Yeah. I just downloaded Headspace. Have you got that app?
Yeah, I did.
Someone
told
me
one.
This is the way.
I did one.
Oh, my God, stop, because I did one. And now I get an email every day going, have you forgotten to do it again?
And I thought, God, this is amazing. I only have to do this for 2 minutes. I feel great.
And then I thought that went by fast and then never did it again.
That's terrible. Yeah, it's exactly what I did. Yeah.
Okay, so I want to read out a quote from you, Gosia, which pins down exactly how you view sustainability in fashion. And it is, to me, sustainability is being mindful. First and foremost, it's about making and growing something in an ethical and sustainable manner, or recycling and reusing if not. And the second part is, I also want to make sure that everyone in the production chain is being rewarded fairly for what they do without being exploited.
Mm-hmm.
And that's off the Koto website.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me a little bit about that. I mean, they're big things, but first of all, this idea of being mindful.
Well, I mean, for us in the workplace, it goes beyond the clothing. So we are just about to open our flagship store, which is exciting.
And where?
In Wellington. And we've put our workroom above it. And we've engaged with architects that have inspired and creatively want to work with sustainability. And we're working with Rufus Knight, who's done all the Lonely Stores, but he's picked our project on because he's also excited about the challenge of this. And it's great. It's like being mindful is easy when you just eliminate everything else. So she comes to us with only 4 options rather than 100 because we just don't even want to know about the others.
Oh my God, the beauty of less choice, because actually too much choice is one of the biggest problems in modern life.
It's amazing. So you go, you can use the New Zealand eucalyptus for the slats, and we can use Osmo oil because of these certifications, and if we want to darken up the grain in the wood, I've got this stain. Oh, well, that's easy. So do you want to go light or dark? I love it. I'm like, great, yeah, perfect. And we know the guy, John, who milled the wood, who cut the tree down. I'm like, this is amazing. She's like, I speak to John every day. And then the countertop, we've got a huge counter. It's 3 metres long. It's a big space to the shop, 200 square metres. And we've been doing collaborations with a ceramic artist, Gidon Bing, in Auckland. And he's designed all the tiles for the countertop, which we're going to grout in. So, and then the sides of the counter are also a sustainable material. The carpets that we're getting are from Cavalier Brenworth, which is, you know, quite an old school New Zealand company, but they make beautiful wall carpets. But they've just created a line of carpets that's made from recycled nylon, so plastic bottles. Just amazing. It feels like wool. It's insane, the technology they've developed. And the sofas are made by Simon James in New Zealand, and that's another amazing, gorgeous interior designer and, you know, furniture designer in New Zealand and Auckland that we've paired up with. And it's just not that hard. And we've got these beautiful paper lanterns coming in, and it's those round balls that you get with the wood that goes through them. You know, you could probably get them IKEA for $5, but these are like the really oversized and super beautiful, and they're from a store in London called 2021, and they did a collaboration with the guy who designed the Olympic torch. And he went back to the village in Japan where that traditional method is made.
Oh, wow.
And we've bought them from there. And it's just such a cool story. And you just think, just this idea of being mindful for me now. It's like going to a restaurant where there's 5 things, or the guy tells me what to order. It's like, this is great.
Oh, my God, my favourite thing is when the guy tells you what to order.
Oh, yeah, it's too hard. I don't know.
But
I don't
they know.
It
but
just,
that's also because they yeah. know. So you're deferring to the expert. It's
totally.
Their sphere of knowledge. Why not say, Bring it on. Share it.
100%. I totally do that now. I just leave it in their hands. And, yeah, so I think for us, I feel like with this new venture of going into retail and really putting in a lot of effort into our workroom and making it a special space, I think, I don't know, it's just been very natural, very natural.
On that subject of mindfulness and our lack of headspace mutually, maybe we need to go back to the app. How are you structuring life now that you're living in London with a three-year-old?
Mm-hmm.
Your business is still based in Wellington. You're opening a new store in Wellington.
Mm-hmm.
We are having this interview in Sydney where your PR is based for Australia.
Mm-hmm. So what happened was when I met my partner, I was having a baby, I needed to employ more people. So our team has almost tripled since then. And I've been fortunate enough to employ some really amazing, creative, big thinkers. And they have generated more income for the business to then employ more people. So
It's like the power of letting go, a bit scary, but good.
Amazing, not micromanaging. I highly recommend it to everyone. And then just trusting people, really, and really honing in on their what they want to do and their skills and what they're good at. So being a good boss, I think that's it. And I've got an amazing head of creative operations, so she runs the show for me. Yeah, so when I'm in London, I'm still the creative director, so I still need to be in the design presentations, and it is difficult with London because 9 p.m. is 8 a.m. in New Zealand, so working from 9 till 2 a.m. and then waking up at 6 with a child is backbreaking, literally, and that's why we're back here for the summer to kind of give me some respite and tackle that. I just kind of think any of these issues are actually, they can all be ironed out. I don't see them as permanent anymore. I feel like everything has a solution. Yeah, yeah.
That's empowering.
Yeah.
I bet people are listening going, yes! Well, you're living proof. You're making it work.
Exactly.
Day by day.
And the business is growing. You know, we're in over 200 accounts worldwide. We show the range in Paris and London and Tokyo and Los Angeles, New York, and all through Australia and New Zealand every year. And the vision for the business from day dot was to have it as a global business. So me living globally and gaining inspiration, and there's real value of being in London, in Europe, because fashion there is so heritage driven and it's so beautifully crafted that it's a real inspiration and a challenge for us, you know, just to really, I now want to be like them, you know. That's the hunger, you know. I don't want it just to be another white shirt. You know, I want something that feels like there's a lot of craftsmanship that's gone into it.
Let's talk about craftsmanship because let's talk about how you make and where.
The production chain starts in India, and we still have two factories in India. So one in Kolkata and one in Mumbai. The Mumbai factory deals with all our knitwear and our wovens, and the Kolkata factory deals with all the basics, so the cotton jersey basics. And the reason we've kept it there is because the farms are in India, the cotton farms, and the factory has a direct relationship with the farmers to have a transparent production chain.
So you talk about seed to garment. What is seed to garment for Koto?
This was something that I was very passionate about from the beginning. So I wanted to know that whatever I made, whatever product it was, and it is fashion, that from the beginning it was traceable and right for the environment and right for the people. It's quite simple, really. Like, you don't have to be a scientist to figure this out. And so I went, and I've gone straight to the farmer level, and our production manager's been to farmer level, and our head creative's been there, and we document the chain. So it's just fascinating. You know, these are small-scale farmers. They have 1 to 2 acres of land, and they practice organic farming techniques. So one of the practices they do is they grow 2 rows of cotton and 1 row of lentils. 1 to 2 acres of small.
Oh, lentils. I knew about
nitrogen
crops, right,
back in the soil. So 1 to 2 acres is very small. It's about, you know, a few garages worth. It's not much land. And you're sitting there in someone's home. They've got cotton buds piled up in the back of their house. It's like a mud house. And they're telling you about what fair trade means to them. And they're showing me their bank balances and their bank books. And they're saying, we received our premium and we spent it on this. And we did this for the community. And you know, it just, the nice thing about the fair trade model is that they have a network of people around them, so they can creatively come up with solutions, and they are empowered to do that themselves. They're not bought into a company, so they're not buying into genetically modified, for example, Monsanto seed.
So, well, the corporatization of this stuff dehumanizes it, doesn't it? It becomes a faceless conglomerate.
Exactly.
You can't win.
Well, you become a slave, so they will give you pesticides to put on your land. At a cost, of course.
And also, only a certain kind of pesticide produced by Monsanto will work with that genetically modified crop. So you are basically bonded to using it.
And I've read just a really interesting article this morning, which I want to read to you. It was so interesting. So Monsanto promised Indian farmers that the cotton would reduce the amount of pesticides farmers need to buy to control pests, increase harvest, you know, all the magic words. And the summary was, from this investigation, yields declined, secondary pests emerged, the price of cotton seed rose, and farmers lost the option to buy non-GM seeds. I mean, it's like the complete reverse effect. So, and I, you know, you hear it. So they have to buy a bunch of pesticides. They put it onto their land. The next season, the crop requires double the pesticides. But you don't get the pesticides for free. You have to buy them. You don't have the money to buy them. So you get a loan from the pesticide company with interest, and then they cannot afford to pay off that interest. So this is why there is also a statistic of farmer suicides in the industry.
I will just use this moment for a shameless plug for the book Wardrobe Crisis, because there's a big section on organic cotton production versus conventionally grown cotton production, in which I tell the story via Catherine Hamnett of how dire this stuff is when it comes to Monsanto's hold over India and the cotton belt and farmer suicides and poisonings and poisoning the land, poisoning children. It's really intense. And it's corrupt.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't have the answer to say to the world, you know, like, could we just survive on organic farming practices and organic food? I don't know that. I don't know if the population has tipped over the edge. I have no idea.
And I think but that I know most that, would say it's not possible because there's not enough land. But it, I don't know
But
either.
I don't know. I don't know that. But all I know is that I feel that if I just do my bit, and that if I'm selling a product, I want to know that that family's being looked after. They've got food. They're producing lentils. They're not having to deal with chemicals. And then I can make clothing and
without
and
feeling it. Culpable.
Yeah, and I just think, well, that's my bit. That's my bit. I'm not doing more harm, you know?
So what's allowed you to do that? It's fair trade, because you can rely on the fact that fair trade certification means that the cotton that you're buying has been produced that way.
It's a real big network of non-profit organisations. So the Fair Trade Labelling Organisation comes into it, GOTS, which is the Global Organic Textile Standard. There are so many more. When I went there, I realised how complicated it was and how many people were involved in helping these farmers. I mean, I was listing in my diary, like, these are the main groups that we list, but I felt like there was just so many passionate people. And I was a bit blown away, because I just thought that India was just corrupt, that I thought everyone's just out to make a buck. And I said to them, why are you growing organic cotton? Why are you doing this, you know? And they looked at me, and I had a translator, and they said, and I knew it was genuine, and they said, because this makes sense. Like, we don't want our kids to suffer from the chemical poisoning. And I thought, oh, because this is why I'm doing it, but I'm not connected with you. I'm in New Zealand. I'm not connected in growing the cotton, but that's exactly the reason why I would grow something like that. And it was so, I just felt like, oh, this makes sense.
But these people are back to practicality.
It's completely in line with my views. There's nothing different between us. There was nothing different that you're a cotton farmer in India. You still share exactly the same values as me, and that values have nothing to do with creed, colour, social status. It's exactly the same. I thought that was a bit of an awakening moment for me. Yeah.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. It was just exactly the same. It's like, we're the same. Yeah, I want to hang out with you for the next 2 months now.
And you did?
Well, I spent a little bit of time there, but I've been
How
on
How often do you visit?
Well, since I've had Laker, not often, but before Laker I was visiting every 6 months, and now we have a production manager that visits every 6 months, and we also have a contractor who is British, but her husband is Indian, so she travels for us there quite frequently, yeah, every month, just to check up on production and all that manual boring stuff that's the same for everyone in the industry. You know, is the stitch the right length? And
but how important is it to keep that connection regular that you are, or people from the business are, Kotoites, are on the ground making those connections, keeping them
huge,
strong?
Huge, huge. Yeah, really big. And I think it goes down not just on the factory level. It comes to me being here in Sydney and me visiting our retailers around the world. And we've just realised this, how as a global brand, we've just got to all travel a lot more. And phone and email and Skype are just not the way, I feel like they're not the be-all and end-all of communication, which I thought it was. And I think it's, to me, it's about face-to-face now. And I guess I've been inspired by my friends in London who have really great jobs, and they just get on a plane and go to Milan for the day for a meeting, because that's what
we
do.
We can do it from London. It's really hard from Australia.
But they don't pick up the phone.
Yeah.
They go there, and yeah, it's still a mission. You still got to go to Heathrow, and you still got to get through customs, but they do it. And I just thought, yeah, we need to do more
of that.
But
I always worry about the eco footprint of flying too much, especially from Australia, but I still do it.
Yeah, I know. We're looking at offsetting our carbon at the moment. So there's some amazing initiatives in New Zealand to do that with.
Can we talk about New Zealand? Because I feel like New Zealand is ruling the world, not in a strange colonial way, but in a way of setting an example that we need to follow. Jacinda Ardern made me happy.
So happy. She's my age. She's 37.
So Jacinda Ardern's just been, at the time of this conversation, perhaps, I don't know, a few weeks ago, made New Zealand's Prime Minister. She is 37. She is rad. She looks rad. She's cool. She has said that she wants New Zealand to lead on climate change.
What does she say?
She seems so personable. I watch her speak and I think finally someone with sense.
You can be hard with compassion. I think, you know, don't quote me on that, but it was like that gist. And I thought, yes, like you can be both, you know. You can be convincing and you can be powerful, but you can do it with compassion, you know. I thought, you're cool. I like you.
It's cool to have a woman.
Yeah.
In power.
And she's a DJ.
Is she? Shut up.
Yeah. Do you want to see her DJing?
Yes. Stop it now. She's like the coolest woman on the planet too. She's number 11 in the world's coolest women.
She's a DJ.
This is another one of those moments on this podcast when I wish that we were videoing it, so that you could see what I'm seeing, which is that Gossier has just shown me a photograph of Jacinda Ardern DJing in St. Jerome's Laneway Festival, punching the air on the decks. And not looking a dag, looking cool. She should be wearing kotau.
Because she's a DJ.
Does she?
She does support New Zealand design. So I've seen her a lot on to the lead up of this, wearing New Zealand designers. So yeah, we need to send her some kotau.
The reason why I mentioned her was because I wanted to ask you if my view is in any way accurate, that New Zealand's just a little bit better at getting it when it comes to sustainability and ethics.
No.
No, really, because I have this vision of a land full of vintners.
No.
Growing organic vegetables. Really? You're shaking your head.
No.
You're bursting my bubble.
No. I think marketing-wise, I think New Zealand is very good at explaining their image. I think Tyco just got some slack in the press for exactly saying what I'm saying, because he's like the New Zealander of the year, and he, when someone asks them exactly the same question.
Clean and green, is it?
Yeah, and so I think we're really good at that image, that marketing image for tourism and Lord of the Rings, but it's a film and it's been edited, that's the country. And I think because we've got 4 million people, which is hardly anyone really, we're lucky enough that we haven't damaged everything. But our waterways aren't clean. Our farming practices aren't great. You hear about it all the time. I'll go up north and hang out with my friends and say, let's go swim in that lake. And they say, no, you can't. It's polluted. You can't go in there. But it looks perfect. They're like, no, you can't go swimming in there.
Oh, we talked about this with Vincent Stanley in an episode last season, where he talked about the hidden damage that's done to the environment. And he said in the 70s, when there was less regulation and the air was visibly toxic, as it is in places now like Beijing, it was harder to escape the fact that we're ruining our natural environment. But now a lot of this stuff is hidden. You can look at the perfect, pristine coastline in Sydney and go, everything looks fine.
Exactly.
And not even know that Chevron plans to drill the bite.
Exactly. So it's like, I am being a complete pessimist. I don't want to like detract everyone from coming to New Zealand because it's insanely beautiful. And I'm about to take my partner on a South Island trip to show him how insanely it is for me, the epitome of natural beauty. There's nowhere else I've ever been that's as beautiful, for sure. But I think we're not a progressive society. I don't feel it. I don't feel it with the city council regulations. It just all feels a little bit dated and not progressive. I don't know. That's just my general kind of gut feeling from it. Just being up, just opening the store and kind of the hoops and things that we've had to jump and some of the ideas that we had, which I think are just so rad, and they don't want to do it because of council regulations or, you know, and that kind of goes into, I guess, the beauty of architecture and where the landscape's going in terms of visual man-made beauty. I don't think we're very progressive with that. But you never know, like with Jacinta Ardern, I think we've had I'm not too familiar with New Zealand politics, but maybe we've had a government that hasn't focused in on environmental issues.
What role do you think fashion has to play in trying to drum up more of a care factor towards protecting the environment? Because I always think, often people think, oh, well, fashion, nothing, it's clothes, isn't it? It's what you look like. It doesn't really have a part to play.
Mm.
But as a giant part of the global pollution problem, as a giant global business, it does have a part to play. And I think that designers like you do a lot to help swing conversation towards this stuff's cool, to care is cool.
Yeah, and I went to the Copenhagen Fashion Summit. Have you been?
No.
You need to
go. I'm desperate to go.
I think you would really like it. And they have some really great speakers. I was a little bit cynical when I went there, and I came out feeling pretty positive. And there is a designer in New York called Eileen Fisher.
Oh, yes. She's a legend, doing great work.
And she's amazing. So she had a mountain of clothing, and she didn't know what to do with it because they decided to have a service in their stores where you bring back your unwanted Eileen Fisher. And I don't know whether he got a discount or something. I don't know.
They resell it, don't they?
Well, they had a mountain of it, and she didn't know what to do with it. She had storage lockers full of this stuff, and she was like, what am I doing? And they decided to put this out as a university project, into a New York university, and say, if you come up with the idea, you can run this. And a girl in her early 20s came up with this recycling, upcycling idea, but in a really modern way. So they've started up a factory in New York where they recut the clothing and remake it, and they've rebranded it as a different sub-brand of Eileen Fisher, and they resell it in the stores. So it was just such a clever way of,
isn't it,
of creating, but they created a brand out of it. So it wasn't just a token rack in the shop that looked vintage. I think they recreated the shapes that were modern for the time.
And also, and not having to say the only solution is to recycle fibres, whether mechanically or chemically, and start from scratch, saying, actually, no, we can do something more innovative that has fewer steps, so lesser impacts.
Yeah, that was fantastic. I really, really enjoyed listening to that. Yeah, and I think for us, we're having this conversation at the moment, like, do we introduce man-made fibres? Because what happens to them? And I know you can now create nylon out of, say, fishing nets in the ocean or plastic bottles. I met another guy at the Fashion Summit who can create swimwear fabric. And I thought, wow, this is great. But then it's like, what happens to that? I want to give it a go because I think swimwear you can't create out of cotton. But then it's like, we need to think about this 360 life cycle, which is what the whole Fashion Summit was about, this idea of circular design. So what happens to it at the end? And I think, you know, I just think it just requires a little bit of industry talk to come up with some good solutions. I don't think it's impossible at all. Eileen Fisher did it. So with opening up our retail store, I think it's great. It really challenged us into thinking about it, how our retailers would think about it, rather than it just being, we work in our whip room, we design, other people sell it. Now we really need to come up with solutions. And we love those conversations. We're a bunch of geeky greenies at work. It's great. You know, that's what we get off on, intelligent conversation.
And actually, the fashion industry is full of creative brains. If we just shifted slightly our conversation and our thought patterns towards trying to find more solutions in this way, of course we could do it.
Yeah.
If you can think of that many ways to make a croc chic,
then
I think that you can think of new ways to reuse waste.
Exactly. I mean,
that's... Crocs aren't chic anyway. Soz, mate. I'm not into it. Making the Crocs embellished. I say no.
Yeah, bedazzling the Croc.
Mind you, I like a bedazzle, so maybe I'll be into it. You're just pulling the face of the minimalist. What is that?
I just don't understand Crocs. Maybe for my son.
Okay, I just want to finish up by asking you a little bit about how much you've seen this landscape change since you started 11 years ago, when what you wanted to do was create this value-based brand. Back then, not many people were working in that way, right?
No, not at all. And I used to say to people, I've had to change the language a bit, so rather than as things have shifted. Yeah, I've had to change the language a bit since the landscape has changed as well. So just choosing my words right. So before, I would talk to people with so much passion about the Fair Trade Labelling Organisation and our workplace practices and how we go into so much detail about everything, and you could see people's eyes glazing over, and they'd call it free trade instead of fair trade. And I thought, okay, I really need to adapt. This is 11 years ago, and people were just kind of sort of buying apples at the little funny farmer's market store. You know, there wasn't even an organic shop. And I just would then think, okay, well, I'm going to sell it as clothing that I'm passionate about, because I'm passionate about that just as much. And now it's great, because now I can do both. I still have to read people when I talk about the clothes, but now I can talk about, people are now educated to understand what it means, what words are ethical means, what sustainable means. But I need to go into a lot more depth for people, because our buttons are made in Italy from recycled hemp. Our denim is made in Germany. So we don't work with countries that don't have workplace standards in place or a fair trade chain like India. Germany is part of the EU, so we're happy to work with them. Italy is also part of the EU. They have minimum wage. So we get tax for our denim, they're nickel-free, they're also made in Germany, our paper for our swing tag.
Everything.
Everything, like everything. So, and I love that, and the team just loves it. So
sorry, tell me about your swing tags and your packaging.
So the swing tags are FSC-approved paper, and it's also, as I was going to say before, it's not getting stuck. We have to individually package every single garment to protect it. You have to do it. It kills me. And you just have to do it. And so we used to do recycled bags, and now we're doing cornstarch bags.
Oh, great.
No, but now we're thinking going back into recycled plastic bags, because the cornstarch bags, we don't actually have a way of recycling them in New Zealand, whereas we've got an initiative with the Sustainability Network in Wellington where we could get the recycled plastic, then recycle it again, and they're making plastic furniture out of it. So it's just about really not being embarrassed to go, actually, this isn't working, and what is the best for the environment that we're in right now? And nothing is perfect, but having that cutting edge conversation, which I sometimes feel like, oh no, people expect us just to be like the be and end all of all answers, and I just hope that it decomposes. Oh, I don't know. And now it's like, no, actually, that's not working. We don't know what's happening with those bags. It's that life cycle again. And there's these amazing people in Wellington that are doing this, so let's do that, you know?
It's constantly evolving.
Constantly evolving. So constantly evolving.
What would you say then, to finish up, would be the biggest challenges that you face when it comes to this stuff as a business? Because as you grow, does it get easier or harder?
I think it's getting easier because there are more people giving us more options now, which is great. And maybe we have a bigger team, we're able to really look out and spend a lot of time on research to get what we need. I met someone at the Copenhagen Fashion Summit that's making fabric that feels like cotton poplin, but it's made from orange peel.
Oh yeah, I've heard about this.
Amazing.
Ferragamo pineapple leather. Used it. Yes.
Amazing.
Pinatex is a wondrous thing. Amazing. That's the pineapple leather.
Amazing.
It's really clever.
I was like 100% orange peel, and it was a very high-end designer that was using it and digitally printing on it.
Salvatore Ferragamo, who were the first luxury brand to use the orange fibre, and they used it on a range of scarves.
Exactly. So I saw them hanging on the rack, and it literally felt like a mixture, but it maybe felt like a cotton poplin slash with a silk mix. It just felt... like it didn't feel like an orange peel. I just blew my brain. I thought, this is amazing, amazing.
And actually, you're right. Every month, there's a new innovation that can help us lift our game here.
And it's like, maybe I'm tapping into it by going and travelling the world and talking to these people and opening myself up to new ideas. But it just seems to be like there seems to be something like you said, every month. And it's really exciting for us as a brand to be able to know, well, for me, you know, 11 years on now, suddenly it feels like we're at the beginning again, and there's all these possibilities.
Oh, it's getting hard. that my parents feel that. And if an angel would tell them all that they are wrong, because I love you.
Thank you for listening to Wardrobe Crisis. To learn more about our guests and the issues that we've spoken about today, hop on over to my website, which is clairepress.com/podcast. You can get in touch there, and I really hope you will. I'd love to hear from you. And you can also find links to my social media. And finally, if you're enjoying the show, please head over to iTunes and subscribe. You know what they say, first in, best dressed. Subscribers are first to find out when there's a new episode, and it also helps other people discover Wardrobe Crisis, so I'd love your help with that. Because the more people who switch on to ethical fashion, the better. Music is by Montaigne. She recorded this special acoustic version of Because I Love You, which is from her Glorious Heights album, especially for Wardrobe Crisis. How good is that? Thank you, Montaigne. Because I love you. My parents feel that. This is a waste of time. I tell you we're okay. I won't admit that I am blind. My friends don't feel that. I'm carrying us too. I tell them all that they are wrong. Because I love you. Because I love you. Because I love you, because I love you, because I love you.